This is Snakes and Otters, a pointless discussion of eternal questions. Get ready. We're about to live in your head rent-free.
Hello, Otterites.
I am Martin.
And I'm Robert.
And I'm Francis.
I am Marcus.
And I'm Andre.
And I'm Cajun, and we're out here at the ranch in the Holy Land today.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Love it in the Holy Land.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be at the ranch. This is awesome. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, today we are going with part three of our Western Expansion series, and we're going to be covering the Indian Wars or conflicts or however you want to say that.
Genocide. Yeah.
Political genocide is yes. A good one. I would agree with the genocide bit, but I don't want to step on anybody else's toes on exactly how they're going to define that. So with
I like it, just calling it a period of great shame.
Yes.
Oh, very, very great shame. Mm-hmm. Yes, this puts shame. Catholic shame to shame.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, very, very well, very good, sir.
Well, yes, because it crosses all religions.
It is. There's mm-hmm. lots of blame to go around here. There's no question as to that. Mm-hmm. And I think we've come a long way. I'd like to think we've come a long way. But, you know, it's not that far of a walk back from to that point in time.
If you've actually been on a reservation, you might disagree with that.
Oh, absolutely. We should talk about that because yes, we went through that. Me and my middle daughter, when we went through Wyoming and Montana, we were along the edges of some of those reservations out there, and poverty does not even begin to speak of it. And I know the first knee jerk reaction will be, oh, casinos. I'm sorry,
yeah, not all of them have casinos.
No, that's correct. And even those that do, I mean. Well, we're going to talk about all that.
And even the money that filters back from the casinos that may be split among the tribe members mm-hmm. of the proper amount of descent these days, a lot of it goes to drugs, alcohol. Yeah. There's a lot of problems on these reservations that they're not improving the quality of life with that
extreme
money.
Extreme poverty is so difficult to climb out of because it's systemic and it's widespread.
Well, it's generational.
Money. That's correct. And that's,
I have no idea what to do to climb out. It's like, this is all we know, and how do we even begin?
Yeah, and who's to blame for that? That's what we'll talk about that.
Go ahead.
The land that we've assigned to them is shit. It's barren land.
Yeah, they did not get the best. When they did get good land, we took it away from them again.
Exactly.
Well, that's right, yeah, because every single, and I'm sure I'm not stealing your thunder on this, I hope, Cajun, but every single treaty the United States government ever made with any Indian tribe was always broken by us.
Worthless.
Yes.
It was broken whenever it suited those in power.
Yeah, the signed paper cannot hold the iron.
Mm-hmm. It must come from men. Yeah. That's right.
So, Cajun, and specifically, though, you are wanting to focus this primarily on the Plains tribes.
The Plains, up towards the Dakotas, Wyomings, mm-hmm. I mean, all the way out towards Arizona, New Mexico, the Apache out there, and so forth.
The post-Civil War era.
Post-Civil War.
So we're not really not doing the Northwest Territory type battles in Indiana and Illinois, and we're not doing Seminole War here and Trail of Tears, although I think we did want to.
We definitely cannot pass on mentioning the Trail of Tears. I mean, that was
a prominent episode
and was brought up a little while ago. Mm-hmm. Of course, Jackson's policy started a lot of this out. Yeah. You want to add a few words on that?
Well, you know, Jackson is one of those characters in American history that we love and we hate.
He's on the $20 bill. Mm-hmm. And there's many people that say he shouldn't be.
And we've talked about him in a good way many times on the political non-Indian war stuff, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But we also did note his role in that. But you can't talk about the problems with the American relationship with the Native Americans mm-hmm. Without talking about him, because he was instrumental both in action and policy.
Yeah.
Right. Because you know he got Florida, those he didn't kill, he moved out as president. Now later presidents finished it.
Yeah,
but he started it.
Yeah, he's sort of the progenitor of this idea of move them off the land and
right.
And well, if they happen to croak on the way, so what? You know, mm-hmm. We've said I think before in an episode that. You know, Jackson is probably the only U.S. president you could plausibly charge with genocide.
I would say certainly. I don't know if he's the only one, but certainly he is one that you could do that. That's correct. And that because it was policy. It was deliberate policy.
It was
stated. There was no bones made about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was sheer greed. We want them out of here because we want what they have. And when it's not theirs, it's ours. And it goes back. We've talked about manifest destiny and how that rolls into that. This is one of the darker functions or corollaries from that manifest destiny.
And now that you brought up manifest destiny, I think it's safe to say that the conflict here is totally two cultures clashing from totally different points of view.
Oh, absolutely.
White people came over here and started taking and thinking that they owned things, where the Native American culture, they did not believe that they owned things.
Exactly.
In the village, everything was owned and part of the village. If it needed to help somebody, it would help somebody else.
They had what was called a
stewardship
mentality.
They didn't own the land.
Yeah, stewardship mentality.
It was held in common good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's one of these things that's you also have to bear in mind that this clash of cultures that you're talking about, Cajun, this is a unique result because in every other case where a stronger people moved in to where and took over a place where weaker people existed, they were either incorporated either by force or marriage, rape, however you want to put it, or they were just exterminated. This is the first time where you actually have this clash of culture where there was no integration or destruction, at least not absolute. Obviously,
disagree with that. The Native American tribes were destroyed.
There are still Native American tribes. That's my point, though.
But they were relegated to points in the area that you're not going to bother me.
I get that. But right. People who were in, say, Great Britain, you know, they were incorporated first into the Roman Empire. They were, you know, the people who can trace their lineage there, they were either incorporated. There's no separate picked culture.
You're talking
and that's
the
part
difference.
Of the culture, too, though. They didn't want to be incorporated into the white man's
right.
culture.
You're talking about the difference between assimilation.
There was no acceptance of the culture of white man.
Yes.
Assimilation versus segregation.
Yeah, and in many places.
And segregation is always basically a disaster.
Well, and most of the time, assimilation is what is intended, and it's done very Darwinian. In other words, if you agree with us, you can assimilate. If you don't, we will kill you. And that's kind of where it falls on it. But this is different.
It is different. And I think that's, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I think
segregation is a very different policy.
I think this is an interesting point.
Get them out of here and send them somewhere else, which I still think is also a function of Manifest Destiny, is there's always more land. They said that in the movie Gettysburg. There's always more land.
But there's not.
As they said in Dinosaurs,
there is
that's what
there
more means.
That's right. You know, there is until there isn't anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. To me, that's just an interesting point that I think it's probably worthy of historical, and somebody should write their doctoral thesis on this somewhere. But
sure
I just
they
think
have.
It's,
no, I imagine
I
they have. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't see it's not something. Granted, I don't read a whole lot of doctoral theses, but it's a point that I think is an interesting one that doesn't get brought up a whole lot. That how we expanded is different than how other cultures moved into new territory and expanded.
Well, nobody wants to put a little spotlight on the shame of it. I mean,
right? Well, yeah,
it's both shame and, you know.
Sometimes I wonder if it wasn't seen as an experiment. I mean, because the Spanish was very much you either assimilate or you die, and even though that assimilation took hundreds of years, essentially there is a relatively homogeneous culture in south of the border into Central America and to South America.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Not completely, of course. There'll always be some.
Here's a piece about that, too, is when the Spanish got over here, and it was not to excuse their rapaciousness or anything, but when they came across the Aztecs, it was like, wow, these are some weirdo dudes.
Effed up mother.
Human sacrifice. That was appalling.
That's correct.
Even though, I mean, again, not to excuse anything about the Spanish because it was
bastards.
Yeah, I mean, it was we're scooping up everything of value and taking it back, but they were fanatically appalled.
Yeah.
By the behavior of
the Aztec culture,
some of the
which was
cultures.
Ultimately doomed to self destruction anyway. Yeah. With the level that they practiced, there's no way they would be
the difference. You know, with this European/American culture colliding. it was a different in perspective, but it's certainly not to the degree of the Spanish and versus Aztecs and stuff.
I mean, you ran into a lot of the same things with the Dutch and their colonization,
yep.
The British with India and those areas there.
Oh, very much so.
Did a lot of the same kind of thing that we did. They isolated the people, and it was easier because they were, you know, a drastically different color.
Yeah, the British, you know, made laws against the whole idea of your loved one died and you're going to burn the body. The family members were no longer permitted to jump on the pyre and self-immolate anymore. That was abhorrent to the British character, so they outlawed it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's a wholly different type of culture clash than what this is here, because I think Cage had really, nailed it on the head. It's the idea of we can take possession of something and make it fruitful versus we're going to roam and share and all that.
Well, now, let's also be fair in this. Is that, you know, it's not like the entire continent was one big happy family.
Oh, that's correct.
Oh, no, they had their own conflicts among the Native Americans, too, but they also had a respect for their enemies, too, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't just, let's wipe out the entire other tribe over here. Yes, we will battle. We'll have fights. I mean, we'll steal your women and...
Right, they were not entirely different from Europeans.
They just were.
I mean, humans are humans, and we suck. So
they kind of coup more than they killed each other.
Right.
That was they feeded their enemies more than they actually killed them. Unless, and of course, you know, in some situations, there was killing going on too. But cutting coup was a great thing to be able to get one over on your enemy without necessarily having to kill them.
Right, there's a large element of pride in that, and you know, it's different the kind of pride that we think of. And I think, you know, there's pride because you're a greedy asshole, and then there's pride because you've accomplished something.
Yeah.
Oh, white man versus Native Americans, right there in a nutshell.
There's something to that.
Wouldn't disagree with that.
Not that you can't have both kinds of pride in both groups.
That's true. That's very true. Well, let's roll it back above the border here and get back out into the west there.
Cajun, because you had some specific episodes you wanted to
discuss. I guess the biggest one we want to look at, of course, is Custer. Custer's Last Stand. Everybody's familiar with that.
Yeah. Listeners, just so you know, Cajun made us handouts.
Yes.
This is the first time we've done this.
Well, no, I am in an internet poor area. I don't have internet out there.
But you have handouts and Robert's studying, and I mean, so this is a unique signpost kind of episode here, I think.
Well, Robert, it's not like I studied before I got here.
But no, but you're studying now.
There's some.
Well,
some
you don't always see it, but you know, I do look stuff up in Wikipedia during
episodes. As we're going.
On the fly, as they say, on the fly.
No, please continue with Custer.
But I was going to say, Custer's a good one to look at, and what prompted that, what happened. And one saying, too, is if the white man wins the battle, it's a victory. If the Native Americans won the battle, it was a massacre.
Yeah.
Totally different.
Very good point.
Yeah, because the Native American has no organized media.
Well, but it's the history is written by the victors.
That's it, too. That's right.
Obviously, I mean, no matter how you look at it. So if you were to ask somebody on the Indian side, when they get slaughtered, would they call it a massacre? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that the way it gets written in the history books, as the Imperator mentions, is, you know, and as you are implying, Cajun, is the victors write it. And, you know, it's an atrocity no matter who won.
Exactly.
Right.
It is.
And that's part of the problem, is that we don't recognize the atrocity no matter what happened. Because it is. The whole thing is just a horrible atrocity.
Yeah, it's also a comedy of errors, too, in many ways, based on this terrible we must destroy from there.
Okay, well, we're looking at Custer. And, of course, Custer, one of the reasons was the Black Hills.
Yes.
Very, very prominent episode. And we had gold in the Black Hills.
Yep.
Of course, had they been moved to the Black Hills from other places?
They had. That's correct.
Already and relocated.
This was considered to be, oh, well, there's nothing of value there. Let's just put them there. Which goes back to that. You know,
and then all of a sudden, We found gold.
That's correct.
And move them again.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we did the Gold Rush episode when we did it, because it really does lay out a lot of the reasons for these things, because we all it would take is that greed, again, I'll use that word somewhat loosely, that comes in, and all of a sudden, all treaties are off. Mm-hmm. You know, all bets are off.
Well, as we talked about, you know, a good number of these incidents where they're moved is specifically because of some kind of gold rush.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Played a very prominent part. Gold, silver, other minerals and such. I mean, it all varied around that. And of course, the Sioux was moved there. Now, the Sioux Nation was not all just one solid people. There were various different groups of Sioux in that.
Yeah.
And they all came together against Custer here at this point.
That's right, which was almost unheard of. They didn't do that prior to, but they had been much further east, and they were relocated into the Black Hills, which they considered theirs at this point, and by treaty even. And then all of a sudden everything changed, and they went on the warpath, just, you know, metaphorically speaking, so to speak. I don't want to steal your thunder, Cajun.
No, that's fine. That's fine. This is all a group effort.
One of the advantages.
We are one tribe here.
Amen to that. I've actually been to Little Bighorn and toured that battlefield myself and middle daughter when we went out there in 2019. We spent half a day at this place, and it is an amazing when you see the land.
Yes.
Then all of a sudden, a lot of things make sense, and they go into great detail at the visitor center. I encourage anybody that gets out there, that's a stop that you must make. It's a driving tour that takes you over the whole enchilada, and it's pretty much untouched land. But you can see the rolling hills, and when they explain where Custer came from, how he came, and all that stuff, because he's coming from the east to the west, it's obvious when he comes over that hill where he makes his last stand, and literally he's buried. They show where he fell. I mean, they relocated his body later to West Point, but most of the rest of them are still there. And it was only in recent years that the local Sioux tribes began to mark, based on their legends, where their people fell. And those gravestones are red, red granite, as opposed to the white marble that was that were for the others.
Let me inject one note here. It was not only Sioux that battled Custer.
That is correct.
The Arapahoe and the Cheyenne also joined together with them, which was very unheard of for that time period.
And a lot of that goes back to the leadership of Sitting Bull. That's come down in our history as the guy with regards to this. He's the Vercingetorix, if you will, of this moment, as for the freedom of his people. And
Wait. You can't drop a name like Vercingetorix and not say who that is.
Well, go ahead. You know who it is.
It's Caesar's opponent in Gaul.
Yes, he is. Exactly right. And there are still statues to him in France today as being a leader of freedom against, you know, imperial oppression. And that's exactly what Sitting Bull was considered to be by not just his own tribe, but the others coming around him, saying this guy has that leadership quality, which is something that we all admire.
As a side note, the study of that battle is interesting when you say, well, how did they manage this, the tribes versus this, you know, drilled and advanced cavalry? So the firepower versus long-distance shooting is interesting.
And that's a good note, because they came out with long guns, pistols, they had cartridges. At this time, there were some of these weapons starting to filter into the Native Americans here and there, and once they captured during battles, but they certainly was not well armed in modern weaponry of the time compared.
But they had more than you might imagine. This is not bows and arrows versus guns.
At this time.
So Custer's men are armed with the single shot Springfield 45-70, which is a devastating weapon at long range, much longer range than other calibers. But it is a one shot at a time.
It takes time.
Yeah.
So they didn't have any of the Henry repeating rifles?
There were a few. They were just coming out. I mean, they were on the horizon. I think there were some already back east, per se, but they had not made it out west yet. That was coming up here within a couple of years.
The natives didn't have that level of distance firepower, but they were able, during those lulls in this controlled firing, to get closer and closer.
Yeah.
Closer and closer. And then their more rapid capabilities came to bear, and that's
And they were experts in close quarters fighting. Right. Yes. I mean, so grappling, though, handheld knives, tomahawks, so forth. Yeah. I mean,
so even though Custer had taken the high ground, which is traditionally how you win, he still got
he was outnumbered.
Out.
Part of Custer's downfall was his blatant arrogance.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
I mean, he was an arrogant ass. That's how he
was. But he's more complicated than that. He also has some. He has good qualities too. He's a hell of a leader. But he thinks his don't stink, and that's But part problem is he's often right.
Yes, yeah, I mean military action. Yeah. He was very good with,
he was.
But he got into a situation here that did not exactly apply to his current knowledge per se.
So let's since we're going to talk about the battle here, so let's throw out some particulars because I think that's important to help understand.
Mm-hmm. By all means.
So you know, when you have cavalry, that right there is usually a huge thing in your favor.
Yeah.
Of course, now they were on the high ground, and obviously they didn't have Obi-Wan with them to make the high ground workable.
Yeah. Anakin, can I have the high ground? Don't do it.
So, but they ended up being relatively stationary on that high ground.
Yes,
so
they fought as dismounted cavalry. Yes.
Right, so that negates their mobility advantage. Mm-hmm. Now, what were the numbers that Sitting Bull brought? Because, you know, he had barely 200 men.
Do you recall?
Francis? Yeah, it was in the thousands. That's great.
Right.
The problem with that is we don't have accuracy on that because those numbers.
The Native Americans
didn't do that. So
sure, but thousands is
that's
enough.
I've heard somewhere between 3,000 to 4,000 at times, as low as 2,000 on the Native American side.
About right. And again, historians in modern times have done a lot of research with the local tribes to try and get that a little bit more accurate.
We'll probably never know.
And the problem being is, after this happens, and Libby Custer deserves a lot of both credit and blame for this, because she took up the cause of her husband's memory and legacy.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the numbers start reaching back east, you've got tens of thousands, if not 100,000s, versus these 600 guys, 200, you know, whatever.
The cavalry trooper, 200 guys.
Yeah, and there was a lot.
Was she the first PR propagandist in the
United
States?
And she was very successful.
Well, maybe not the first, but she was one of the best.
One of the most successful, that's right.
But the point is,
probably maybe the first female.
Probably.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The point, though, is that
she
they were outnumbered
at
least 10 to 1.
They were.
Yeah, that is a very fair statement, yes.
So, and probably more than that, you know, somewhere at 10 to 20, maybe even 30 to 1 at a max. But
yeah, and they were, and they became surrounded unknowingly.
Yes.
They walked into, it wasn't intended as a trap, it's just this is how they all ended up coming together in this particular location. And if you see it, and you hear, and of course, Custer splits his force at one point, that which he doesn't realize the danger that he's in, and he doesn't, he believes he can talk his way out of this. He does not go into this looking for a fight. He really doesn't. He's on an exploratory mission.
Mm-hmm.
But by this point here, there are several other things that have happened that have really incensed these local tribes, and they're out for blood. And
whole village was wiped out.
That's correct. Yes. That's right. And again, not all of this is Custer's fault because he's not the only one out there.
Yeah.
General Crook is the one that's an overall command, and his is an expedition to go out and make mayhem.
Yeah, that's find the villages and burn them.
There are reasons for that, and they are ginned up. They are not inaccurate. There were some skirmishes and things like that. But again, you're talking about months, if not years, of buildup to this moment where all of a sudden everything just came falling apart. Although, in the grand scheme of things, as far as the U.S. military was concerned, this was a gnat. This was nothing. But boy, it sure made the papers because of the yellow-haired dude that went down.
The great blonde Civil War hero struck down by savages.
Absolutely. It played well.
Yeah. It was a rallying call.
Even into the 30s, because if you remember, Errol Flynn plays him with they died with their boots on. This is like 37, 38. And it is exactly a replication of all that.
Yeah, it's a replication of the bullshit stories
that
came out of it from our side.
That's
the white
exactly
man's
right,
side.
Because you know, and to put it in perspective, the Native Americans did not become American citizens until 1935.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just a few years after that. And right at the beginning of Hollywood's love affair with the Western, you know, because this is in the 30s, and they, you know, if we can't you know, we still don't like them, so we're going to make them the villains in all these movies.
Exactly.
And the American public just eats it up. So,
and the strange thing about that, very few were actually played by Native Americans in these movies.
Exactly. Well, absolutely. Yeah. That's right, because you can't have that, you know.
No.
Well, it's not entirely that you can't have that. It's just nobody thought it was necessary to go recruit any.
That's right.
And it's not much different from all the blackface that we saw of
There's an underlying
white facing.
Underlying racism that goes with all that. That's what you work with. There were some exceptions to that, and John Ford was known for that. And I'll give you one of my favorite movies that's very similar to this.
It's all Yellow Ribbon, Fort Apache.
Fort Apache is where I'm going.
you know him well, Cajun.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say Fort Apache is the
John Wayne. That's my preview. Yeah. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. But that is essentially Custer's Last Stand remade over in 1947, but it's done with a fair approach, relatively speaking, because it lays out the Martinet Colonel Thursday, which is played by Henry Fonda, as a prototypical Custer, that he's the one that engages on this because he's a dumbass, because he is out for glory, and he's just hard-hearted and all that sort of stuff. And they actually used Native Americans to play Cochise and Geronimo and these others, which is unheard of at the time. And they're the ones who come off as being reasonable.
Yeah.
And John Wayne, who's, you know, still the star, he's caught in between, and he knows what's right. He ends up, you know, saving his men at the end after this awful disaster of Thursday's Charge. And it's just a great microcosm on film of how, and I think this was Ford's understanding, because it was based on a book that was written around that time, the beginning of maybe we're not telling this properly. Maybe we need to give this a fairer shake. And I think that's one of those beginnings that's taken us to where we are today, that we recognize, you know, it was pretty awful.
I believe that this might be a seminal moment in the
changing. No pun intended.
None intended. Because this is, you know, it's 150 years later. We're still talking about it, and we're in a room full of white men.
Yeah,
and we're seeing the other side of the.
That's right.
Of the story.
Those of us who are Catholic, we call that the movement of the Holy Spirit on a global scale.
Good one. Good one.
I think it's very true. I think we're trying to get better. At least many of us are trying to get better.
Well, for us here in America, I mean, the West is our romantic period, like compared to the Knights of Old in Europe and so forth. I mean, that is the glorious time of exploration and so forth here.
Taming a continent. How could you know? You don't get any more romantic in the grand sense.
And yet we're trying to put a dose of realism to it in now, just barely 100 years after the fact, and realize, you know, that romance was a lie. It might have been fun, but it's a lie.
I don't think it's a lie.
It's
incomplete.
It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, there are a couple of pieces missing out of the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Exactly. Where are we at on time? Are we getting up to
28 minutes.
That's about time for it. You want to hit that button over there, Robert?
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Bourbon break.
All right, we've got, we're all drinking the same thing today. We're drinking Wyoming whiskey out of Wyoming. Anybody that's a Joe Pickett fan of the series of the books will be familiar with that name.
Absolutely. If you haven't seen it, it is one of some of the best stuff on television. It really
stunning
is.
Scenery, too.
Very much
I
so.
Mean,
it's based on the novels by C.J. Box, who is a phenomenal author. He's taken a modern American twist on the West, similar to the way Craig Johnson did with the Longmire series.
Yeah, so Pickett's a game warden out in Wyoming,
absolutely.
And they are pretty much always out on their own. There's no backup because they're miles and miles usually away from anybody.
Which gives you fascinating narrative possibilities.
It does. And nice thing about Pickett, he's got the unique style that his books, I've read them all, and each book has a year span between the book. The first book, he starts out as children are small, not in school. Mm-hmm. And by the time he's up in the 20th book, so the oldest is already in college. So each
he's
book has a year between it. So he's working on a very nice linear timeline.
Essentially real time.
Real time, yes.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's there's value in that. That's where, not to go off on a rabbit hole, but we do that. So series of books do well when they're written that way, and those are what tends to sell. But we'll talk about that at another time. We're talking about bourbon right now.
Well, let's go over to the Imperator, our official snifter of the group.
Well, I mean, you know, I've smelled it, you know, since it's been the ice has been melting a lot into it.
We're using the circular cubes too.
Yes,
actually, that's
spherical. Yeah,
yes. that is absolutely
it's mellowed out,
more
but,
oxymoronic.
I mean, the first thing that hit my olfactory senses was the wheat in this. And you said, I believe it's a 20% wheat in the mash bill.
Yes,
which is a heavy wheat. And it's very, I mean, it was very distinctive. Others had noticed the sweetness to it.
There's no rye whatsoever in it.
No, yeah, 68% no. corn, 20% wheat, and 12% malted barley. This is cooked and made in Wyoming, all from local grains, all non-GMO. And I mean, in my opinion so far, I think it stands up to anything we make here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know me, I like to kid around.
You're the purist.
Not entirely, but I like to kid around about it, you know? You know, because we do have a phenomenal place. The birthplace of bourbon there's just so many factors going to it. But as it says on the label here, I find this very fascinating. Apparently they have a similar limestone aquifer to help filter their water, and their water comes from the glaciers.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is snow runoff, mountain runoff.
Yeah,
cool stuff.
That I think is going to, you know, help it by leaps and bounds to achieve the quality that it has. And it has a very fine quality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I love there's
88% proof, was it?
84%
alcohol.
88 proof.
88 proof, 44% alcohol.
There's a sweetness to it, I think.
Very much so.
Yeah, and that's the wheat, I think.
It's
the absence of any rye. I'll take that.
Yeah.
It stands well against any wheat bourbons around here to me.
Well, and the malted barley brings a heavy, you know, caramel and leathery.
I'm becoming
kind of thing to
more
it.
And malty, more of a fan of that malted barley. I think it is a wonderful ingredient.
Well, the malted is
and here's to the Scots for starting that up.
That's right.
Yeah, well, when that's your starter, you always have to have that. That's your catalyst for your fermentation.
And the malted part is what really helps, because we were at the tasting with the Jephtha Creed distiller, one of the few women distillers, master distillers. I asked them, you know, all right, so what exactly does the malted part do? And if you are going to have a high rye bourbon, you probably want to have malted barley, not just barley, because that malted part where they wet it down, and they get the enzymes reacting, and then that helps temper the spiciness of the rye. And so having all of that stuff going on, all of the chemical reactions, just it helps all of it. I think it helps the wheat. It helps the rye.
Oh, this one's got a hug that's just now coming in. Yeah.
I tend to look at the barley along the same lines as, and this would be for those who aren't bourbon-y people, but maybe bakers or what have you. It does the same thing as adding vanilla to your baking goods.
Oh,
it mellows it. It brings out more of those kinds of flavors.
Yes, it mellows it.
You know, it gives you a more even keel to the whole thing. It brings it all together.
Yeah, I would totally agree. The vanilla, I totally get that, but I only got it after it bloomed. I tried it before I had some ice melt in it, and all I got was a very good sweetness, and it was delicious. But after it's bloomed a little bit, I get that vanilla that comes.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, I will say one thing. If I was walking through the liquor store and I saw this, until I tried it, I would have turned my nose up, kept walking, and never purchased it.
Yeah, a lot of people would.
Now I'm going to go out and buy it.
Yeah, same here. But is that because we're Kentuckians?
Yes.
I'm just making sure.
I mean, if I hadn't been catching it in the Joe Pickett novels and so forth, so it kind of became, I got to give that stuff a try. I've read about it now through 25 books. I mean, how close is it to a good product around here? But I'm also getting a little citrus off of it, too.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I bet.
I'll have
it's,
to.
It's not a super complex bourbon, which is fine. You know, it's one of the things that I think the really snobby bourbonistas are really bad about, that it's got to be high proof and lots of complexity and all these different flavors. And honestly, sometimes that's just too overwhelming.
This is a good comfort.
It's just good.
Exactly. Yeah. This is a comfort.
I call this a good comfort.
Well, no. This is a comfort whiskey.
No, it's a bourbon.
It's a bourbon. It doesn't have to be from Kentucky anymore to be called a bourbon.
It's a legal bourbon.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's a
moral bourbon, we don't know.
Yeah.
It's a capital B bourbon. It's a lower B bourbon. Let's put it
it's
that way.
Branded as Wyoming whiskey. That's the actual brand name. But that's,
small batch bourbon. It's
small
also
batch bourbon
what
is what it says
as.
Underneath that. There, it's got a. You know, I love the comfort and the straightforwardness of it. It's very different, say, than say Wild Turkey, which is the regular Wild Turkey, 84 mm-hmm. proof, which is very, very similar in proof level, but that's got all these other. It's got pear and it's got all these cherry and all these other things to it. That doesn't have any of that.
So I think this one is very well served by being low proof.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the sweetness to it. It comes across again. Touch of vanilla, especially at the mm-hmm. end, the very end of the flavor. Maybe a little candied almond, that kind of thing.
Ooh,
butter mm-hmm. toffee, maybe just.
I was going to say, well, our master taster
it's
here,
not super heavy,
he's the
on
one
that.
That
but it's right. It's not candified really, but it has that sweetness. It reminds me a ton of the Log Still Monk's Road Small Batch, which is also weeded.
Mm-hmm.
And a kind of a moderate proof, so it's a very similar profile.
Really?
Maybe a similar profile, that. But one of the things about this,
not to the Fifth District,
right.
But
yeah,
the small batch is more of a weeded.
Now this is about a $50 price point. They have different variations, of course, like anywhere. Some a little bit more, but Total Wines and more in our area, up in the metropolitan area, they sell it for about $50 a bottle.
I tell you what, Total Wines has a great selection.
They do.
Oh, and they'll let you taste just about anything they got in the cabinet.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a great
within reason.
One of the things I find interesting about this that I'm noticing more as we have spent more time with the higher proof bourbons
mm-hmm.
Is I've come to decide that probably anything 100 proof and below really got to limit the ice.
Okay.
Because
I can see that. Yeah.
The ice really dilutes the flavor pretty quickly. There's a, no pun intended, a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, most
to
definitely.
To get the right bloom versus watering it down too much.
You want to bloom differently for lower
proof.
Probably
want to have the smaller spherical ice balls instead of the large one for a lower proof. Or
I think
either that or
alternate solution is
or drink
faster.
Drink it faster. I was going to say
or drink it faster. Yes.
Yeah, drink it quickly.
But
yeah.
If we do
only
that,
have big balls around here, right?
Yeah, only big
Agent's
balls.
Big spherical's out here at the ranch. It's a fun ride.
It's got a really nice finish, though, even even as it's diluted a little too much by now, because you know. This is probably sitting here for 40 minutes before we got to it.
Drink faster, as Andre says.
Well, no, I passed him out just before we started now, so.
That's, yeah,
right, well, about half an hour.
By the time, it's 30 minutes before we, unless you were drinking a lot.
I mean, I was sipping, but.
I mean,
that
we all tried
too.
Early on,
before. And that's why I could tell, you know, the difference between the first bloom and now is I got that baseline.
Well, just suck it down.
And the more it bloomed, that's when I started getting the citrus off of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's got an interesting, which is almost a little bit of a. Oaky flavor at the end.
It does. And
the tongue.
Well, of course, you know, with that malted barley, you get that kind of peatiness too, like they do with Scotch whiskeys. And
But the hug is not, it's all up here in the upper chest.
And
it's
very
it's
delayed.
Delayed.
Very
much
delayed,
so. Very
it's
delayed.
Not
nice,
intense.
Warm, subtle hug.
That's right. Yeah. It's not in your face. It's not, it doesn't smack you upside the head. It
doesn't
make
you gasp of breath.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I go back to that, you know, that 120 proof. Old Forester Prohibition style, which I had a headache the next day.
Or that Wild Turkey Rare Breed.
It's called a hangover.
Well,
or Booker's.
Or Booker's,
Well, you know, Booker's didn't do that to me, but I haven't had probably enough of it. We've had it a couple times. I almost didn't get
some last night, and I was looking at the bottle, and I realized this bottle's going down a little too fast. Even though I've got a second one of these, I think I'm going to hold off and go to something else. I had some of the Jim Beam Black Extra Aged last night, opened up that bottle.
Nice.
Another one, again, too much ice just dilutes it too far.
Mm-hmm.
And again, would not have known that if we hadn't expanded our palates because
that's
we
right.
have really
We're moving along the bourbon trail.
Skyrocketed the number of bourbons that we've tried in the last year. Thank you.
Yes, we were counting bottles amongst our different collections.
Let's go ahead and say it. Let's go ahead and measure those things.
We were doing a measuring contest amongst men.
Unzip and get them out.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say it was necessarily a measuring contest because I think all of us knew we would lose that one when it came to it.
Yeah. Y'all are coming closer.
Well, that's true.
Coming closer. I hit 75 unopened bottles.
Unopened. Okay.
And I don't, and some of those are duplicates now. I have several bottles of Blanton and a couple
of dupes on the Weller, the Monk's Road,
Knob Creek, and
I mean,
I've only got very few open bottles. I've had to make an effort to finish it up, the opening bottles
I'm
that y'all leave me with.
Make yourself an Invinity bottle. I mean, that's
that's not my game. I can't get my mind on that one.
Well, I've got a gifted bottle that's designed for that my kids got me, which I've not used much of, so my intention is to kind of go there.
I need a little more research on that. I think you probably should be a bit ostentatious on exactly what goes into that Infinity
bottle.
Absolutely.
Things
are not going to mix well with others, where some would.
Well, that's
maybe if you made
testing.
A Wheated Infinity bottle, a Rye Infinity bottle, I think I'd keep separation there on the different.
I'm still looking into it myself. 31 bottles myself.
In the old West,
75.
They would call an Infinity bottle the slops, and that was the cheapest drink you could go into a saloon and order. Because
that was also back before they had the bottled and bond, so you don't really know what was in that slop.
Slop is a very appropriate term.
Spit, some rat heads, snake venom.
Mark, what's your bottle count?
So I'm only at like 13, open and unopened.
And do you know?
I'm around 10.
Okay. I'm sitting at 27, only two duplicates, because I got two bottles of
And the one who doesn't drink is up to 14.
There you go.
But you have intake but no outgo, so that would make sense.
Well, you know, you have to be able to...
Oh, it's all outgoing and he's not intaking.
Offer some to your guests, of course, you know.
Right.
In the Indiana estate.
And Francis, your number?
31.
31, yeah. So, by the way, Cajun, again, my eternal thanks for the gift of the china cabinet from your parents' place. Just a phenomenal setup.
It is pretty cool.
And we'll actually be moving the second one, the smaller one, right up here today.
Oh, excellent.
It's going to go right there.
Oh, okay. There you go. So you can
feature
your favorites there, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Maybe your open bottles.
You've got those in the back now. So, what's really interesting is that... you know, when I first got it, I thought, oh, man, it's going to take a while to fill this thing up. So now that I have reached 27, I've actually taken the large bottle of Makers that was gifted to me when the former pastor moved out of the rectory.
Yeah,
because he didn't want to take it with him. It was because it was gifted to him. He's not a Makers kind of guy. And I've had to put that on the top to make space on the two shelves. Part of the problem is that the bottles like this. So this Wyoming whiskey comes in a nice round bottle. It's like the Peerless bottle.
Not real tall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But because it's a fat bottle.
Yeah.
And the fat bottles take up a lot more space. And so it's a lot harder to
Ship the things. Yeah, because the Eagle Rare is
more
of
us to love.
Way much more narrow footprint-wise.
Right, so the Rabbit Hole, the Two Monks Road that I have.
That's
right,
because they're
like
square, rectangular.
Those, they slide in nice and neat, and, you know, they can
1792 is way wide.
Well, it's wide, but not deep.
That's correct.
Yeah. As I look across the top of the cabinets where the bottles sit, if you notice, though, most do have a roundness to them.
They do.
There's truth. Woodford Reserve is an exception.
Less square rectangular. Knob Creek is square and rectangular.
That's right. Yeah, those two. And Monk's Road is square. Mm-hmm. But most of the rest of them, you're right, they are round.
Yeah, so it makes it a little bit more difficult to really squeeze as much in as I would
it's
like.
It's a nice problem
It's
to
a
have.
Nice problem to have.
Is that kind of like if you build it, they will come?
That's right.
Yes.
You place it there, they appear.
That's right.
Apparently.
Is that what you're telling the
You buy
missus?
Them, they are drunk.
Well, that's right. Well, you know, there is nothing better, I think, than bourbon to share. That is really what this is all about. And it's a great pleasure that we all get by each hosting.
So if you share, you're a connoisseur. If you don't, you're just a drunk.
Sure. There's something to be said for that. Yeah, that's right.
You know, it was interesting. I was listening, speaking of whether you're a drunk or a connoisseur, this doctor had done a study on the effects of alcohol. Because, you know, obviously, alcohol, we know this, even though we drink, it's a poison.
It's not natural to a human being's body.
Exactly. And high amounts of alcohol, especially in women, for instance, are associated with breast cancer, which makes a lot of sense because my mom drank a hell of a lot and she had breast cancer. That's what she died from. But anyways, apparently, because you know, she was talking about, well, you know, there's if you're a heavy drinker, it's like, all right, well, when are you going to define what a heavy drinker is?
Yeah,
yeah.
So, because that's important to know. So apparently, up to about 10 ounces of whiskey a day is
that's a good amount.
Is considered a heavy drinker. And she now, she, I presume she meant a day because, you know, up to 10 ounces obviously is not an absolute number after that because, you know, very quickly.
If you go a ounce and a half per drink, I mean, that's four drinks with an ounce left over right there.
Right.
To give you a proper image of that for non-drinkers out there.
So. Right. And, you know, I don't think I've ever had more than, well, other than we did the five flights at yeah. my place. You know, four is the most I've ever had, and those were smaller amounts because yeah. they're in the.
Well, if you think of your pop, regular pop bottles of 20 ounces, it's half of one of those. You're drinking mm-hmm. a half of those every day,
right? And yeah. and that's a lot of whiskey.
That's a lot of booze.
Pure, yeah, that's yeah. pure. Mm-hmm. Not including ice or mixers or any of that sort of stuff. That's,
right. I'm so assuming. You know, I felt good about that because you know I. Now that I have all of those bottles and a little bit more, mm-hmm. not quite in my face, but you know they're not sitting on top of the fridge, so I see them more often. So I'm much more likely to once or twice a week have a glass of bourbon in the evening.
Yeah.
All right. Well, has anybody else got any thoughts? We probably need to run this on back to where we was at for the main episode. Yeah. Any other comments on the Wyoming whiskey?
Bring it, I love it. Bring it on.
Let's good stuff. Go try it.
It's worth yeah. a purchase.
Yep. Oh, it's on my list. That's for yeah, sure.
And I'll just note good. That the cat is right at Steven's head.
Well, it was
sleeping
on Francis's head.
Now, it was looking out the window earlier, so if if Francis would have turned around, he would have been staring right up Lucifer's ass.
Oh, boy. Yes, we did.
He will face down Lucifer in its
yes.
in all his glory. That's correct.
Uh-huh. Francis is not a pet person.
I am not a pet person, and we have let everyone
right
know
in
that.
His head.
Yes, my cat is named Lucifer Morningstar, after the TV character. Not yes. necessarily I'm trying to raise demons, and I do call him Lucy more often than not.
Yes.
Well, you know, we found out today, Brother Andre and I found out that little Oliver, cute little.
Oh, did Adiva.
Apparently. Francis thinks he's a bully.
Absolutely, he is.
That
short people usually are. Look at Bernadette from The Big Bang Theory.
Well, that's true. but he Francis believes that Oliver bullies him, and I just have a hard time seeing that.
I didn't say he bullies me. He bullies you all because those of you who walk in, he barks.
That's not bully.
No, this wants you to play.
When I get home from work, my wife barks at me.
Oh, I hope she's not.
Wow,
listening to this.
She doesn't listen, does she?
She listens the first half.
Well,
okay, yeah.
You're screwed.
All righty. Well, let's get back on track.
Your wife is wonderful. We love your wife. She's a wonderful person.
We think she's wonderful.
Yeah, she'll like you all.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways,
skip a bit, brother.
Okay. Now, this subject matter that we're on today with the Native Americans and conflicts is just too wide-ranging to try to cover everything. So we're just hitting the highlights here.
Sure.
Custis, and everybody knows. And let's jump to the last part of it with the Red River War. And go from there when Sherman became involved.
You're talking Texas, right?
Yeah. Right.
That's right, yeah.
Right.
So at the time, Sherman is, I believe, chief of staff, which was numero uno military person.
Essentially under the Secretary of War.
Yes. So normally that position would be in D.C., but Sherman loathed D.C. and moved his headquarters.
He was a real general's general. He got out in front there and...
Yeah.
He moved to St. Louis and basically took command of this personally.
Yeah, he was only about 3,000 troops going into this.
Yeah, he wanted to be disconnected from D.C.
Yeah.
Even though this is during Grant's administration, am I correct? Or is this post that?
It would be
It'd
be his second term.
I think Sheridan
and Grant and what he attempted to do in
early 1870s. Then, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
Red River War was 1874-1875.
That is still Grant. Yeah, because Hayes didn't take over till 77. That's when Reconstruction
ended. 1870s.
Yeah. And Reconstruction is still going on in the South, which is significant as part of this because that is, you know, Sherman has an enormous. Influence over all of that.
A huge amount of responsibility.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. And yet he decides this is going to be my personal command. Says something about the man himself and about the necessity of what he's perceiving, correct or incorrect, of going on out here to what he would call pacifying the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's everything was set up in such a way, obviously, that you know, we have a hard time understanding. But as Cajun pointed out, with the natives not even being American citizens until the 1930s, you know, you can, and I'm sure that they did at the time, make the argument that, you know, this is a nation, which they are still considered separate nations, even though they are
American citizens. Sovereign territories to the Native Americans of the reservations.
But you know, without even that benefit of citizenship, it was truly set up as an us versus them.
Very much so.
Yeah, because it is viewed as like going to war against another nation.
Right, and you know, and that's obviously unfortunate in so many ways. It's hard to see where a right step was ever taken.
That's very good. Yeah.
I mean, we mentioned Grant attempted it because one of Grant's character features is that he does not like to see people mistreated.
Very much so.
And so he made attempts to bring in the Indian agents, they called them then, to deal with the tribes in a more fair way. But it was just so hard to control.
A lot of corruption.
Not
that all Indian agents was bad and corrupted. There were some out there that tried to help out.
The movie Fort Apache shows that
there's some nothing conflict corrupt. To it because he's bringing in religious people to do it. And then that's kind of like, we don't want to do that. But you think about at that time where your only communication method is the telegraph, trying to control someone in Arizona, New Mexico, Wyoming, whatever, from D.C. and regulate their behavior and know what's going on in order to remove the corrupt agents is just close to impossible.
And you mentioned the religious aspect there, which we heard the missionaries coming in and trying to convert and stuff, and it always wasn't done in the nicest way either.
No.
Beating, starving, all kinds of things that are not really appropriate.
The TV series, and I'm hoping you're going to mention it. I was thinking of 1923.
It was 1923.
It was 1923 that showed that in its worst,
somewhat
exaggerated, but not inaccurate.
I would not say that would be exaggerated. I'm sure there were examples of that happening. It may not have been as common, but not necessarily exaggerated.
Agreed, and that's Taylor Sheridan trying to.
And I think where you're going is exaggerated in the sense that this is presented as the way it always was,
or that everybody did it this way,
right?
That's never a truth.
This is an attempt to show the extreme,
right?
That's the most sincere, and it makes the most drama,
right? And you know, it was an interfaith effort too. It wasn't just focused on the Catholics.
No. Right.
But it was Catholics, every stripe of Protestants.
It was very hard as a faithful Catholic to watch that series.
It was.
And I loved that series. I really did. And I can't wait for the second season. But, it was...
Are they going to do a second season?
Well, they have to because the story's only halfway done. But, yes.
Yeah, but there was talk about whether or not they were going to do one.
The strike interrupted it.
The strike interrupted that. No, there's definitely going to be the next part of that. Nobody's quite sure where Yellowstone is exactly headed at the moment. The main...
Supposedly, the last half is going to drop. It's going to be filmed this summer and drop in November. I think that's wishful thinking. There's only one, and Kevin Costner said he's not going to do any more episodes. He's filmed some of that. So what's going to happen around that? Who the heck knows?
Been talking to Matthew McConaughey coming in.
And he's supposedly going to do a spinoff after this. And how the heck they're going to do that? Good question.
I don't think we'll see any more of the Yellowstone main series after it wraps up.
They've already said it's done.
Any form of fashion.
They've got 10 episodes that they're committed to making to wrap this story up, and supposedly the back half of this season, and that's it, folks.
Yellowstone is a great example of shining a light.
Very much so, yes.
Because, the episodes that I've watched of the first season, I've not watched all of them by any stretch, just because...
I was to say, Cajun and I...
Too distracted.
We've watched...
Jump around.
I think all of them. Anybody else here watched all the rest of them?
Yeah.
Andre, you've watched all of them, too. Yeah. That's right, yeah.
I've started to watch Yellowstone, and I thought, no, I'm going to go back to the beginning, watch it in chronological
order. And you should, because it's that good, because it's really one family story.
Exactly.
Holy mackerel, yes.
So,
Go ahead.
No, why am I wrong for watching it in chronological order?
Oh, because you get the base of the story in current day, and then you build on the history by going back and watching
1883.
I haven't watched 1923 yet, and that's on my to-do list.
I was going to say,
Then you have not watched all of them.
Liar. The Yellowstone.
Yeah.
That is Yellowstone.
Yeah, in many respects, 1923, IMHO, might be the very best of all of them. Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren are hard to beat.
1883.
I tell you what, I thought 1883 was the bomb.
It was good. It was absolutely good.
And using Faith and Tim, that is a married couple, as the couple on there, I think added that extra spice.
They nailed it. Yes. They nailed it so well.
The chemistry, of course, was wonderful.
It was already. They already had the chemistry.
Yeah. Right, right. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed that there wasn't going to be more of the 1883 story.
Well, it's
and
hard.
Then when
funny thing is,
along,
the executive says, what are we going to do for season two? And he said, you didn't say anything about a season two. I've already wrapped it up. Everybody's pretty much dead.
Right. Well, when you get to 1923, I hated the way that opened because it felt like it just shit on.
That's
1883.
Right. I mean, yeah, because Andre's taking off his earphones because he doesn't want to be spoiled.
But my point, though, about Yellowstone, that white man versus the Native American mm-hmm. battle is still very prevalent.
Still going on. Oh, yes. Very much so, yeah.
And it really brings that to light because, and the funny thing is, you don't know who the bad guy is in that first season. I don't know if you do later on because you've got the Kevin Costner character who is obviously done some bad things.
Yeah.
But then you've also got
Gil Birmingham's
the guys on the Native American side that are doing a lot of very bad things too.
And that
there are no good guys in that, which makes it
human,
great.
Yeah,
of course, not all ranches and stuff had conflict with the Native Americans. There were some that worked well together, respected each other. Charles Goodnight had a pretty good relationship with a lot of the tribes in his area on it with his Texas ranch back in the day.
I will say this with regards to the Yellowstone piece. And the Native Americans, Gil Birmingham's character, who is the leader of them, he's very much like Jakar in Babylon 5.
Yes.
He starts out in a place that's not that great, and yet he grows to the point where he is an amazingly complex, sometimes out of his depth, but very driven individual. And sometimes he gets he's not always in charge. Later in the seasons, I mean, there are people that try to, you know, not almost say usurp him, but go around him and marginalize and minimalize him. And
well,
that's a great story.
Once you start down the road of terrorism, which is where he starts.
That's right.
Yeah.
You can't pull back.
That's
right. Because if you do, you have betrayed the movement, and the younger hotheads, which I'm sure is who try to go around him.
You were exactly correct.
Are the ones who will take it to its logical end. Because once you start down that road, you either have to continue or you become a victim of it.
Which gives that character of his a great moment of this moral crisis of, I must not allow this to continue, because he is a moral character. But you don't know that until you've watched him long enough and realize he's not going to do that. Martin is almost peeing in his pants over here trying to say something.
So to move back from Babylon 5, which I'm not sure how we got from the Indian Wars to Babylon 5.
It's a direct line. I don't know how you can't see that.
But back to Sherman.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so in the Red River War, and again, Sherman is chief of staff, the number one military position. He's very heavily influenced by his relationship with railroads.
Yes.
And that's the driver of, he sees...
It's his troop transport.
Yeah, he sees the railroad
out
as,
west.
This is the future. This is how we overcome what we've been through in the Civil War, is the railroad.
He sees World War One.
He sees tying the nation together with the railroads.
Yeah.
Who's in the way? The Native tribes.
Americans. Yes.
Well, and actually, if we go back to this Red River War period, that's not what started the conflict. The conflict actually goes back to the reservations being so bad that several tribes, different tribes, left the reservations to try to get somewhere better and banded together, which included the Arapaho, the Cheyenne, the Comanche, the Kiowa,
Escaleros.
The Tatka.
Yeah, and that's Cochise. I mean, that's part of what's in that movie.
Yeah, what's driving Sherman, though, is railroads.
Yeah.
He sees that as the future. He wants that tie. Because it becomes tied a few years later, is 1880, roughly 1880s. So it's not that far away that the whole country is going to be tied together by the railroads.
Well,
and that is the artery of both command and control and
I wouldn't say the whole country yet, because it's obviously the East and the West have a direct line.
Right.
But there's a lot above and below.
And so then the next step is, all right, what do we really need to do to win? And that's take the food supply. That's the bison.
Yeah.
A hunting.
But
and that's a whole other sadness, the slaughtering of the buffalo bison.
Sherman's approach to war, all the way back to his Civil War days, was a scorched earth
policy.
Right,
that's the way you win.
That's the way he did everything.
Yeah, so that's...
Because it worked.
Yeah.
Take out their food. Take out their homes. Take out everything that they have. And then the policy was followed through by the government to take away their children.
Re-educate
them. Send them to basically concentration camps. Re-educate them. Take away who they are, all of their culture, all of their history, reform them, and then ship them back.
And which some of that was in the 1923, basically, is what we were seeing there.
That happened as far, into the early 1900s, even here in Kentucky. My grandfather was taken away for that. So was his brother, because that was policy around here. If you weren't...
Which is ironic, because that's the whitest man in this room.
Me? Yeah.
I don't know. Martin's pretty pale.
Yeah.
Now, of course, my kids, that's a whole other story. We raised our own Lillarian nation. I mean, you can't get
there are
much
two
blonde.
Yeah. But, I think that what you're talking about there, that goes back to the worst way to do what, and again, I'm not saying this is what should have been done. I'm just... I go back to that assimilation versus destruction. Yes. Would we have been better off trying to assimilate as opposed to segregating and destroying?
Probably.
And
I think that's it's always better, because at its best, not its worst, but at its best, assimilation is two-way.
Yes, and it's one plus one equals three.
Yeah, because you're absorbing
the difficulty is in maintaining enough of the culture that is being assimilated.
Yeah. We did a little bit of that, but not a lot of that.
To use a cliche, you only assimilate if they have something that you want.
Well,
that's the worst part of it.
They have some kind of value to whatever you're bringing them into.
Right, because obviously...
And if they don't have any value, you wipe them out.
So, well, and that goes back to Cortez and the Spanish. Yeah. Do you want to assimilate a culture that practices human sacrifice?
No.
So, the answer is no.
Was there anything worth assimilating besides that? I mean, there's great... I don't know. I'm just posing that question.
Well, their astronomy was leaps and bounds beyond...
And their mathematics, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they did have a few qualities beyond ripping out beating human hearts.
Yeah, well, it was the establishment that was destroyed. The people themselves ultimately were assimilated by... force of arms.
And let's make it plain and simple. The higher-ups was the ones doing the sacrifice, the religious part of it there, while the common people was in fear of their life, pissing down their leg, waiting to be taken to be sacrificed.
That's right. So it was the establishment that was destroyed, not the people, generally speaking.
Right.
And
maybe that's one of the big differences, is that there wasn't that same kind of hierarchical structure in the tribes that inhabited
the
territory that the U.S. took over.
That's a lot of it. There's no monolithicness in that, whereas there was in the Aztec culture and the Incas as well.
Yeah. Right. Well, back to that. I mean, Sherman, we said, came in with 3,000 troops basically to kick ass on 700 Native Americans.
Yeah.
Which he did.
Yep.
It was pretty much considered a rout, massacre, what have you.
Mm-hmm. Rousing victory.
And the ones that survived went back to their reservations.
Yep.
Because they had no other choice. I mean,
that's
considered the last major conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it wasn't the last by far, we're still seeing stuff going on now. Even today, like we said earlier, look at Alaska and the Native Americans in Alaska. They're still fighting and trying to regain lands and so forth. Well, not that they're not in the lower 48, but I think it's more prominent up there as a current thing.
Well,
it's more current.
Yeah. Well, assimilation is behind schedule up there, whereas here it's...
I mean, what did they have up there?
There's no assimilation here, even.
Still.
There's a question to that, though. And that goes back to what we were talking about either in the show prep or early on, is the reservation system is still essentially intact. And for whatever reason, my question is why?
Well, it's now become the culture. I think
that's where we're going.
It's not the law anymore.
It's what they used to.
That's yeah,
what people get used to.
Well, and some of it is cultural because they do not want to leave their tribe, and I get that.
But
is that it?
It's you have to understand. They may not have been there for 300 or 400 years in those reservation areas, but generationally, that's the only home people know.
That's right. Once you get past four generations, memory is gone.
And it's no different than what we run into here a lot. There are a number of people here in Kentucky that have never been across the river to Indiana. Same with Indiana people coming back. I mean, people don't tend to settle more than 18 miles from the home that they're raised in.
Most people die within 50 miles of the place they were born.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's why I moved out of Michigan.
People do not move and see things, experience things, because where they've grown up, even if it's just completely distasteful,
yeah,
it's still the only home they know.
Well,
it's mine.
You're saying that, though, like this is some kind of aberration or bad thing. This is true for all of human history.
This is.
Well, it is true.
I mean, it's the norm.
Yes.
And very few people have the fortitude to blaze that new trail.
Exactly.
And they're considered anomalies and sometimes
even crazy people.
Yeah. Yep, correct.
Yeah.
Now, the modern technology has allowed us to travel like we've never been able to do.
Modern technology has made that ability to go beyond those 18 miles.
But it's kind of against our nature to do so.
Yeah.
And I think with the reservation system still being a thing, like I said, it may not be the law, but it is the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a place where someone like you has authority.
And it is safe.
If you were to move out, you have to submit some authority to someone who isn't like you.
Yep.
And that's hard. I don't care who
it is.
You are.
It's psychologically difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to touch on one more thing because I'm sure we're getting near a wrap up.
Close to the end.
Yeah, we're getting. Yeah.
Wounded Knee Massacre.
When I was
8 years old, my maternal grandfather introduced me to two books. One was The Trail of Tears of the Cherokee relocation, and the other was Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Oh, yes.
I would highly suggest if you want more information and views from the Native American side, read those two books.
They are still
eye-opening.
They are classics even today, and you're right. They changed our culture, the white culture, tremendously. It's amazing what that one book, the Wounded Knee book, did. And there was resistance to it. Huge.
Oh, yes.
I mean, at our ages, we should remember the protests that took place there when we were kids. I mean, that was part of our culture. And most of it for us was like, what?
And
explain this to me.
Well,
and we couldn't.
You didn't have a lot of that coming out in the white mass culture for the United States until it was Brando's win of an Oscar.
Yes, it was. That's right. For The Godfather.
He refused it.
He refused it.
And he sent Sachin Littlefeather in.
And she did. And that was the start of general protesting.
Right. And he got an enormous amount of ridicule for that and still carries that today. Don't you know?
That's only been two Oscars refused, if I remember right.
His and George C. Scott was the other. That's right.
Why did George C. Scott refuse?
The whole system. He did not believe in the system.
Yeah. Which system?
The
Oscar system.
Oscar system.
Actors competing.
Actors competing. He says, you know, we all are doing great work. Why are you doing this?
Exactly.
But you're right. Brando, I mean, and let's not mince words, he was a very strange individual in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of it became, once he became a superstar, it took off from there. But he nailed it exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
He was ahead of his time with thinking like that. And a lot of what he did, our generation took notice of.
Mm-hmm.
Those in power at the time ridiculed him, but time is kind of on his side with that.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'd recommend to anybody, any of our listeners, travel, meet new cultures.
Because you can
experience things.
Well, hold on, though. You say that.
Yeah.
That's not entirely true.
Yeah.
No, it's not complete by any means.
It still takes a lot of means.
It does.
To be able to travel and meet new cultures. So
it does.
Let's not make it sound like it's nothing.
Look around your local area. There are cultural aspects of every Native American throughout the entire United States. You are close to several tribes at any one time, no matter where at in the United States, that has history, education centers, so forth.
Yeah, you know, and you could even take it beyond just Native American. You know,
any culture. Exactly.
Almost every large city is going to have.
And I just focus on that because of the episode.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, you're right. Yeah, because you're right.
Any immigrant culture that's come into this country.
Oh, yeah. We could talk a long time about that subject, but we don't have time.
There's a very simple way to experience other cultures and without ever leaving your home, and that's to experience food.
Yeah. That's the first way. Mm-hmm. That's where peace is made, is over the dinner table.
It is
I
very
truly
elemental
believe in that. Yes.
Part of a society is what they eat, how they prepare it. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And just in our city of Louisville, there are many, many immigrant communities who love to do that. Mm-hmm. We have, and not to toot our own horn, but we at the Archdiocese where I work have run have had pre-COVID, we would have what was called Days of Human Dignity, which we're starting up again for next year, where all these local cultures, usually they're in the Catholic universe, bring their own food together in one event early in the year to enable people to know that we are much bigger, much broader, much more diverse than any of us realize.
Mm-hmm. So he just danced around the phrase, didn't he?
I did.
The inherent dignity of
the human person.
Well, that's, you know, hey.
So,
you're right.
Yeah, I think
I know Martin loves it when I bring that up.
I mean, I think that's a good place to start wrapping.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it always takes us forever to wrap up anything.
It does.
Cajun is an excellent captain, though. I know you'll bring us where we need to be.
Yeah, so just, it's a shame we didn't get more time to discuss the buffalo hunt.
Oh,
and the
will.
Eradication.
It
of
was
bison.
Just too much. We'll circle back to these
that
things. We're not done with our Western.
Well, we're going to do
series,
a railroad episode.
We're going to jump up
so
a little later.
That's a good place for that to go.
A key component, and there's some scholarship that maybe contests the notion that they were hunted to the brink of extinction. But the reduction in numbers is what essentially breaks the native resistance.
It is. It's like Sherman's scorched earth. He took away the main food source.
Yeah. So exactly. I mean, without the free roaming bison to hunt, the only option to
and eat, to follow.
Yeah, the only option to eat is to accept the reservation.
I mean, these herds went from the East Coast all the way out west.
Way
I mean, their migration routes went back and forth across this country as the weather changed.
Yeah. Yep.
They used to come through Kentucky by the thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back in the day, if you want to read something along that lines, I mean, go back to Daniel Boone and so forth, the early settlers coming through the Cumberland Gap.
Right. The Bourbon Buffalo Trace is named that for a reason.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So I guess that puts us to
our next one. What's coming up?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, we're going to do Code of Honor next. After we've done a history, we're going to always do Code of Honor. Cajun has something in mind for this one here. I'm not going to spoil it. But as usual, he's got some really interesting quotation. He's already signed it, already given it to us. It's going to kind of continue this discussion in many ways. So we'll think that you're going to find this to be an excellent next episode. So be here.
We hope you enjoyed another pointless discussion of eternal questions. Remember, new episodes drop every second and fourth Friday at 6 a.m. Eastern, just in time for your morning commute. And every fifth Friday, we drop a special Hoopajube episode. Spread the word, we are on all the major platforms, and leave us a review. That helps others find us. We're also on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, as well as our website, snakesandotters.com. Join us next time, same snake time, same otter channel.